Okay. Good afternoon, one and all. Good afternoon. Okay. A little service announcement for everybody. As you can tell, this week we are meeting. Next week we are taking a day off in honor of the American holiday, Thanksgiving.
That's Wednesday.
That's Wednesday. I'm going to be in transit, so I could in theory do it by Skype, but... Well, I'm not quite the airport, but I'll be in the car. I'm going to the American city of cars.
Detroit.
Detroit. Cars. Automobile. What, Detroit? That's what I've been told. You can buy houses for nothing. That's what I've been told. So if I don't come back, oh, there's something to go up. I'll have to buy a house now.
I can go in the city,
okay.
In the suburbs. I don't think you could buy anything.
Right, right. I actually had a lot of Hollywood movie makers bought up a lot of plots of land in the downtown Detroit because they need to blow them up in action movies. And it was so cheap, and they actually wanted to demolish whole sections of old buildings. So they went in, and Batman was filled down a couple of them, just blowing stuff up. So, win-win. So, my wife's uncle, one of her aunts and uncles, live there. So we're going to head out there. Anyway, so that's next week, so we're not meeting then. The week after we will, and unless I say otherwise, we won't. The meeting on December 9th is also in the week of Hanukkah, and it's been suggested, and I thought it would be a lovely idea, if people are possible to come at about 12, we'll meet at 12, have some light refreshments, donuts, kind of hangout time where we can get to know each other, maybe introduce ourselves a little better, so that we know who we all are, and then we'll do something, maybe not the full time, we'll do something before we finish, 12:30, we'll do something.
I'll be in Lakewood.
You'll be in Lakewood? We'll have a donut in your honor. That's 9th. This is the Wednesday during Hanukkah.
I'm leaving Monday to
floor. You're leaving on Monday to floor. 2 donuts we're going to have in your honor. Okay. Anybody else going away?
Yeah, I'll go to the next.
Okay, so you can have donuts. We'll be okay. You're saving my cholesterol. Okay. So that's just the service announcement. Not meeting next week. December 9th, we'll have some sort of light-hearted Hanukkah party, and we'll do something then as well. And otherwise, a couple of weeks at the end of December and the beginning of January, I'm going to be out of the country too, but there will be emails. There will be emails. Okay, so we're in the middle of Perek 52. Nunbet. And this again, just to catch us up, this is a discussion of Doeg and David. David has reflected on the betrayal and the corruption of Doeg and his murder rampage, where he killed the whole town. And again, this is not the simple villain of Tanakh. We might imagine that he's just corrupt and horrible, who's walking with a cane and got a bald cat that he strokes and he's insane and corrupt. We're talking about a figure who had potential. He was ahead of the Sanhedrin. He was knowledgeable. He had Torah on his fingertips, but something went wrong. And for many people, again, it's rooted in his name. Doeg, he is rooted in anxiety and concern. He's easily brought to jealousy. He worries about David having the ear of the king. He's happy to quell any opposition. And that's what he does. And we saw already in the first verse, just to catch us up, v'yaged l'Shaul v'yomer lo, there's a redundancy there. He spoke to him and he spoke to it. So he said v'yaged means there's some craftsmanship going on. He either inserts something into the story that doesn't belong, or he rouses and riles up Saul's anger. V'yomer, and then he comes along to save the day quietly, and he says, oh, no, let me advise you. So he's manipulative, he's sophisticated, he's jealous, he's knowledgeable, he's a complicated figure. And then going into part of Gibeon, we spoke about how David calls him Huggy Bob. This was, in theory, the hero. He was the preeminent figure of the generation who could have steered things in a good direction, but he failed. And he calls him Chesed Kel Kol Hayom, the kindness of God all day. And we pointed out Chesed actually can mean two things. It can mean either kindness or extreme depravity. And it really, chesed just means extreme or beyond. And in good context, chesed is obviously extreme goodness, and in bad, we have the same.
We then spoke about, and this is where we got up to, Pastor Jared, we said that slander and the tongue is like a ta'ar malutash, a sharpened razor. And the Radak, we pointed out, said this is also redundant. Just say it's ta'ar, it's like a razor. We all know razors are bad and sharp. Why do you have to tell me? It's like a sharpened razor. And then we got all graphic, and I remember some people not liking it, but I mentioned the, when you do shlita, there's a very, very sharp knife. And when I was,
I remember I didn't like it, apologies. And in high school, one of my rebbeim or rabbis were telling me about when he trained for shlita, they took the knife to test it, and the way you test it is on your fingernail to see if it's sharp, to see if you catch anything. And he said that it went through the top of his finger and he didn't notice. Because it was so sharp, you just don't feel it. And he said, that's ta'amulu touch, that when you say something that sometimes you don't intend it, you don't realize, you're not conscious of it, you're not aware, but you hurt people. You cut them. And it's ta'amulu touch. That's mirma. That's deceit. And language has that power. Now we're on the part of pay, which is new material. And again, as we're reading, think about ambiguity. That's a big word. Things that might have different meanings, or things that don't belong, or things that aren't there, absences. Ahavat ra is now again accusing Doeg. David is saying, Doeg, ahavat ra mi tov. What does that mean? You love?
Ahavta.
What did I say?
Ahavat.
I guess I'm in a romantic mood. Okay.
Ahavta ra mi tov. I apologize, I need your glasses.
Ahavta ra mi tov. You love evil more than good. And that's what it translates here as well. You love evil better. The good sheker midaber tzedek. Lies more than
righteous words. Say it.
Okay, excellent.
He knew that the Kohen didn't have anything to do with it. He's sitting there.
Okay, excellent.
So we've got an ambiguity because David seems to be painting in very broad brushes, again, falling into the trap. This is just a villain. He loves evil. He loves lies, etc. So I want to look. Maybe we can translate something a little differently. Ahavta ra mi tov. What do we translate that as? You love evil more than good.
Is the man more than, or is the man from?
Right. So that's exactly the ambiguity. How would we read it the way you're suggesting?
Let's see. It would be, you love evil from good.
So meaning?
You're making evil from something that's good. Instead of, it's not diametrically opposed. The good somehow becomes evil.
That's what I was going to suggest.
In Hebrew, it's usually more than good.
Right, so it can mean that. But often what Chazal will do with a drashot is they say, mem can mean a number of things. It can mean than, or it can mean from. And what would it mean to say, you love evil from good? Doesn't really make sense, right? So either you can say that you're so corrupt that you take a good situation and you figure a way to turn it on its head.
Or another way you said it, there are good things in this world that are complicated. And you can extract bad from them.
For example, at the end of Dvarim, when we have 11 curses listed in Parshat Ki Tavo, anyone remember the 11 curses that are listed? No? Okay, good. We shouldn't pay too much attention. They're quite scary. So, people remember this. Arur. 11 times. And they're very, very specific. It says, curses to the people who trip the blind. Curses to the people who don't listen to their parents. Curses to the people who marry their sister. Curses.
Very specific. And then there's one at the end that says, Arur asher lo yakim et divrei ha-Torah hazot. Curses to the people who do not uphold the words of the Torah.
And all the commentators say this is totally dissonant. It's out of place. You've got very particular curses to people who ignore their parents and trick the blind and marry their sister. And then, curses anyone who doesn't keep the Torah. How would you solve it? Sorry?
But that is the Torah.
What is the Torah?
The specific ones, yeah.
Right, so it's redundant, right? Why do you need to repeat?
Because there are other things in the Torah which are not mentioned in those 11.
So why give me the 11? Just give me the one. Then why do you have to give me very specific and then one big one? Okay, so the Radak and others who enjoy or prefer, I guess, short reading, the surface text saying it's for emphasis. It's saying these 11 things, and by the way, anything. Just don't do anything wrong. But another resolution which the Gemara gives Actually, Nachmanides says, lo yakim in literal terms. What does yakim mean in literal terms? To lift up. So he quotes the Talmud Yerushalmi that says these are people who do hagba badly. I said, lo yakim, they do whatever, but they don't lift up hagba properly, they're cursed. So it's called a drasha. Okay, so you could say it's ridiculous, but the rabbi said it, and that's, again.
Who said that?
It's the Gemara Yerushalmi. It's one of the most ancient Jewish texts. Where did they get that? So, this is what we do. We're presented with this. If someone is a complete literalist, you're going to read that Gemara and say, hold on, you're telling me people who ignore their parents and marry their sisters and trip up the blind are on equal footing with people who do a bad hagba. That's what you're telling me? So it sounds ridiculous. So we're forced to look at that and think about allegory, metaphor, symbolic. What does it mean? You're cursing me if we don't do a good hagba. What is the symbol there? What are we saying?
It's a manner of showing respect to the Torah.
Okay.
There are men who really do it with a lot of enthusiasm and switching around, whatever it is, they do these fancy things, showing kavod when they're doing it, showing kavod to the Torah and to the Kehillah. And just
right.
Go, and then sit down.
So what I would do is I would peel back one layer of what you're saying, which is put the cover to the side. What is the activity you said? Enthusiasm. So you lift it up with it, and the people who don't have enthusiasm with Torah, people who don't lift it up, and you might even say, have pride, have conviction, have confidence, say, this is what I stand for. Those are people who are cursed. And then that Gemara actually can make a lot of sense. You say, you curse it is this, curse it is that, curse it is that. But don't think this is just a bunch of curses. You have to avoid tripping up the blind people. You have to be confident and proud of the values we stand for. And that Gemara takes on a whole new tenor, and it becomes applicable and resonant. So that's one reason. Yeah. It mentions in the parasha, correct. Oh, excellent. So you've even got a resonance. It says in the same parasha, I don't remember exactly where, says, you are going to be punished because you didn't serve God, the simcha, with joy. And it's quite possible to link that up. You have to have conviction, enthusiasm. So that's one reading. There is another reading, which I think, I can't remember, I think it's Yabarba now, who says, Yakim, we don't have to read literally, but lift up. But Yakim is to, sorry?
Fulfill.
Uphold, these are all good words, and he essentially says it's quite possible to take the corpus of Jewish law and exploit people, to lord it over people, to say, I'm an expert on Hilchot Agunah and Gittin, and I'm going to make sure no one ever gets a get who wants it. Because I know all the chumras, and I'm going to do that. You can say, I'm an expert on Hilchot Kashrus, I'm going to make sure no one can ever use a dishwasher. I'm going to find a way to get people out of it, and just exploit people, and abuse people, and use good to inflict evil. And the Abarbanel, or the Chizkuni, now that I think about it, I can't remember, says, that's what that curse is. The curse of people who trick the blind, who ignore their parents, who marry their sisters, and I say, lo yakim et divrei ha-Torah, people who don't uphold and fulfill the Torah, but misuse it. And he uses very powerful and poetic words to say, but uses it to thrash people like a stick. He uses the Torah as a weapon. And maybe you can read, that's what you're doing here, Doeg. You are ahava, ahavta, ra, mito. You love the wickedness out of good. You like taking, not just you're wicked and you prefer being evil and murdering people and plotting, but you like taking goodness and exploiting people and lording it over people and taking Torah, which is a corpus of compassion, and using it to beat down the masses. So that's one way of reading that, and that's again rooted in the ambiguity. You love the wicked out of good, which is far more twisted than someone who's a sociopath and just goes around killing, but someone who is sophisticated and should know better and manipulates goodness to make bad. I saw a hand.
It destroys the parallelism.
Why? Go on.
That has a specific meaning, unless you can twist it.
So let's try and twist that too. So the second part says you love lies more than truth. So maybe you could read it, you love the lies that can come out of David's said. It doesn't say emet. It doesn't say you like Shechem more than emet. It says you love lies, midebet said, which means just words.
Now let me ask you a question.
Is it ever just to tell a lie?
Yes.
Yes. Give me one example.
That's a prime example the Gemara gives. So let's just recap. God comes, well, the angel. Okay, so we'll bring that up.
So Avram is welcoming his guests, and Sarah's behind the tent, and she overhears, and the angel says she's going to have a son, and she laughs and thinks, are you crazy? My husband's so old.
How do we know that she thought that?
We don't.
Made that so misogynist.
Okay, what might she have thought?
Abraham laughs, nobody criticizes.
Well, I tell you who does criticize Sarah, who doesn't criticize Abraham. God. God corners Sarah and says, you laughed. And she says, lo. No, I didn't. And he says, lo, ki sechakt. Yes, you did. So that sets it up. But you're right. The Malbim, among others, says we're misjudging Sarah, and actually, when it says she laughed, it was out of pure joy. And she's not critiqued in the same way. But there are textual reasons to think that she's being critiqued in a way that Avram wasn't. Because he falls on his face and laughs, she does not fall on her face, and falling on your face is seen to be an act of submission to God and just pure joy. But she seems to take it in a different direction. It is complicated, and I understand the impulse that it's misogynist. You've got all these male rabbis sitting around going, oh, Avram, he laughs, wonderful. Sarah, disgrace, I can't take it when women laugh. I can see why you have an impulse to resist that, but there are textual reasons to think that too. Yeah.
Now I would have thought that, but I had it explained to me in a different way that made sense, and that's Sarah, as through advanced age, gets her menstrual period and stuff like that again and starts looking like a much younger woman and having the body of that, whereas this did not happen to Abraham. So therefore she could say, well, this thing seems to be happening to me, but look at my husband. It doesn't seem to be happening to him, so how...
Okay, so that doesn't necessarily address the laughter, but that's why she says, my husband's so old. Right? So let's take it back to that. She says, Abraham's so old, you think I'm going to have a kid? That's crazy.
And then, and look, even if it's positive, she still says, my husband's old. It might be, wow, this is tremendous. My husband's old and it's even going to happen. Either way, God comes to Avram and says, Avram, do you know what your wife said? She heard she was going to have a son and she said, I can't have a son. I'm so old. What did Avram never, Sarah never said that. She said, her husband's old. So God should have come to Avram and said, you know what Sarah said? She said, you're not going to have a kid because you're old. That's what he should have said. And the Gemara says, why doesn't God say that? Right, because that would have been a little cruel. But it says, Midaba Sheker Tirchak, stay away from lies. How do you justify it? What does the Gemara say is the justification? Shalom bayit. That some things trump other things. It is not a flat rule that lying is out. And in English we have a term for these kind of lies. They are called white lies, meaning you say something in a different way to be kind, to not provoke anger or incite hatred or insult. Exactly. So it's quite possible when we see here Shekhem Midever said it, you like the lies that come from justice, meaning you revel in white lies. You justify the fact that when he said, oh, David went into Beit Ahimelech, maybe he was near his house, maybe, but you purposely said, I'm going to put it in a way, and it's justified. I'm going to justify it. And you like the lies. And no one should revel in ethically questionable behavior. I don't think God celebrates the fact that he had the lie. He would have much preferred not to have brought it up. But if you have to, you have to, and that's just. And this figure, Doeg, is someone who loves lauding Torah and exploiting the less knowledgeable. He loves taking things that are ethically questionable and justifying them. He is twisted, sophisticated, corrupt, and manipulative. So it's quite possible the parallel will hold. And really, Mer is from. He loves the lies that come from justice, and he loves the evil that can come from good. He's not just a simple figure, black and white. I love evil, I don't like good. I like lies, I don't like truth. But he loves kind of murkiness, where good things can bleed into evil and lies can bleed into justice. That's his problem.
Yeah, there are people like that even now.
People like that, correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. And in fact, how many people were here in Kins on Shabbat, out of interest? Was anybody here?
Yeah.
So we have a couple. So the drasha that I gave this Shabbat, while my throat gave in the middle, was linked to this. Because if you look at last week's parsha, I can recap it very briefly if you like. If we look at this week's parsha, the central piece of Parsha Toldot is extremely disturbing. We have two of our heroes, I can even probably say it word for word, the drasha I gave at this point, two of our heroes, Rivka and Yaakov, plot against Yitzchak. They scheme and deceive him. He dresses up, and Rivka says, go do this, go do that, and what happens? You're right, he did what he was told. There is a scheme that he participates in because he's under his mother's thumb to some degree. Well, we don't know exactly how old he is, and even older people, if they lived at home all their lives, can have a huge amount of sway from their parents. So it's possible. We don't know how old they are at any point. So, and what happens? There's a deceit, and Yaakov gets a blessing, and for the Netziv and everybody else, this is obviously what's meant to happen in history. Yaakov is meant to get the blessing. But what is the result of the deceit? We're told Yitzchak, when he finds out, Saradah, Saradah Ma'ot. He trembles and he tremors. And we're told that this, actually, there's a midrash that says this tremor has happened before. When did he last tremor? When he was tied up at the Akedah. But the midrash says this was even worse. This Saradah was worse than that. He was faced with certain death. And he trembled, and this was worse. He felt completely fooled.
That doesn't make sense. When you're about to be shefted, so
well, so this is the distinction, right? When you're about to be shefted, he knows what's happening. He's not being lied about. He says, you're going to die. And he's just got this physical, visceral response to the fact that he's about to die. But this is a moment when you've been fooled. It makes you feel like a child, inept, stupid, ignorant. You feel like you've got no control. And in one, you've got control and your body just shakes because you're about to die. And in one, you've got no control and you just break down. And there's one midrash that even the house started to shake, I mentioned on Shabbat. The whole situation, it creates ripples. And then Esav finds out, and what are we told about Esav? The Yitzad Tzakar Gedolah Umara Ad Ma'od. He cries out an extremely bitter and great cry. Do we feel sorry for Esau?
Yeah.
I mean, if we hate Esau before we enter the scene, we think, good, he should scream. But if we don't know anything about him, and the Chumash doesn't tell us anything that bad about him, we have some empathy. And I mentioned as well that the only other time in the Chumash where we have a Tza'aka Gedola, anybody know? What's the only other time in Chumash where there is a Tza'aka Gedola? So in Chumash. Right, when the firstborns are killed, that's the only time we have a Tza'aka Gedolah. Ki ein bayit she'ein sham met. There was no house without death. So we get the sense that a national scream of agony is equivalent to Esau's pain, and then a midrash picks up on what happens in Esther. Because the exact same phrase is used in Esther. And it says, V'yizag tza'aka gedolah umara ad ma'od. When does that come up in Esther? When the edict is issued and Mordechai realizes what happens, he puts ash on his head, he puts, what do they, sackcloth, that's what it is. No one knows what that is, but that's what everyone translated. They put sackcloth on, not dressed up very nicely, and he goes into the street, Vizag Sakag Dullah Mara'ad Ma'od. Exact same phrase, the only other time in Tanakh. And it's not just me, the Midrash says it. In fact, it's Rav Hanina, who has an unusual opening. He says, anyone who says God is kind of loose about injustice and just lets things go, he says, your bowels should let loose. That's what Hanina says. Anyone who says God lets justice go loose, your bowels should let loose and you should lose control over everything. That's what Hanina, and one could do a lot about that metaphor. But then he says, because look at this, Yaakov hizik echa leisav, made Esav give a single scream. And when was he redressed? When was there a reprimand for this? Said B'Shushan. Hundreds of centuries later, the Jews of Shushan cry out in pain, and according to Hanina, that's in payment. That's a reprisal for the pain that Esau was caused. You have a question?
Yeah, the parsha ends
Yeah, I mean, it's quite possible that Esau is still held out as a possibility. And he's clearly not written off as a complete failure, although his homicidal cravings and rage, sins indicate otherwise, and he goes off to disappoint his parents, and he marries Yishmael, and he marries this one, and he marries, and he's clearly a disappointment, but in Rabbi Sachs' latest book, he has a whole chapter, how about Esav isn't rejected, it's just a different path. We pick up the legacy of Abraham, and Esav is on a different road, but that doesn't mean there has to be eternal enmity between us, and that's his argument. But I didn't go down that route yet. His argument is no. His argument is no, and he tries to prove it from even though there is a Shema Bar Yochai who says halacha. If he says halacha, Esav sone of Yaakov. I would point out Shema Bar Yochai is also the person who says he's also to have a job. So we can't just pick up the bits that we like from Chazal. Yeah, he says you have to learn all day, and then Mavok between Rabbi Yishmael and Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Yishmael says in Shema, "Asafta deraner Rabbi Ross Rabbi Tzoriacha, pluck corn, gather in your parnasa, and make a living." And Shimon Bar Yochai says you can't do that; you're not allowed. And the Gemara concludes: people followed Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and weren't successful. People followed Rabbi Yishmael and got jobs, and they were successful. He doesn't necessarily judge one or the other, just observe that one seems to function better. And that's not a comment on any system in particular. But all I would say is, we tend to pick up the quotations and citations that feed into the ideologies that either we've been taught or that function. We have to choose wisely. And Rabbi Sachs does address that point. Either way, why do I bring this up? Because what Yaakov and Rivka did caused pain. Yitzchak trembled. Esau, the Jews of Shushan had a reprisal because of what occurred. It has ripples through history of pain, and Rabbi Sachs, I noted, points out, the whole tragedy of this is it was preventable. It could have been avoided. How could this all have been avoided? How could the deceit of Rivka and Yaakov have been avoided? Talk about it. Who should have said something?
Yeah,
Rivka should have said something. Beginning of the parasha, she's got this trouble. She's got something going on in her womb. She doesn't know exactly what it is. She's Dereshet Hashem. She asks God, and she gets an oracular response, like an oracle oracular response, says, you're carrying twins, two babies, and the older will serve the younger. So she knows that Yaakov is destined to take God's legacy. But what does she say to Yitzchak?
Nothing.
What did she say to Yitzchak earlier? I mean, presumably, but nothing in the Chumash is reported. Nothing. What did she say to him afterwards?
She lies to him again. She lies to him again.
So when you say
when she overhears Esau saying, "When my father died," because everybody's assuming that he's on his deathbed now, and that's why he's doing the bracha. But when he dies, I'm gonna mourning's over, and then
right.
It's time to get rid of my brother. So she tells. She tells Yitzchak that she's sending, they gotta send Yaakov away because otherwise he's gonna marry somebody like Esau did, and she
yeah.
can't stand that.
So what I would say is it's not quite a lie, but it is what we would call a half truth. It's quite possible that Yaakov is meant to go and marry from them, and she was really sickened, but she said, I can't tell him about Esau. So she clearly isn't communicative to the full. They don't have an open channel of communication. But that's it. In the whole Chumash, that is the only sentence we have that Rivka says, ever. And it's crazy to think about this, because we think about our matriarchs and our patriarchs as personas. But the rabbis have to fill in a lot of conversation, because the Chumash gives us only one sentence Rivka ever says, and it's that. It says, Kavsti b'chayai, my life feels shortened and strained by these women of Canaan, my son needs to go elsewhere. There's a strange midrash I only saw last week, and I was trying the hardest to find out where they got this from. But the rabbi said, when Rivka said, Kasti b'chayai, she took phlegm out of her nose and flung it across the room, and said, I'm so unhappy with the women of this country, and this is a physical gesture to show you that. And I was scratching my head. Normally there's some inflection in the text, there's something, maybe it says something about off to do with nose, trying so hard to find something, and it turns out it's kind of lost. I've no idea where it comes from. I'll ask an expert on the drug. But if you want to know where someone, I was going to put, sorry?
Google.
I'll try Googling that now. Right, of course. I mean, do the rabbis say that that's definitely what she did? No. But where do they get it from is the question. And that's what I wanted to look into, but that's a good trivia collection question. Who picks their nose in Tanakh? There's the answer. And why? And I don't mean it disrespectfully, although it is a little in jest, but where that come from, you've got to ask the rabbis that, or I'll ask an expert. Because it's quite possible. This is in Bereshit Rabbah, which is one of the oldest Rabbah texts around the year 300. It's quite possible it was plucked out of an older text that had a hint where it came from, and we just don't have it. So I'm going to have to look into that. Either way, this all could have been avoided if Rivka would have spoken to Yaakov, sorry, Yitzchak, at the very beginning and said, look, I'm telling you, Yaakov's got to get it. And there would have been confusion and deceit and all this behind the scenes.
I heard something, and I can't tell you who the source of it.
You're not allowed to, or you don't know?
No, I can't remember.
Okay, not a spot.
Right.
Actually, the Rivka spoke with Yitzchak about this a lot. I'm trying to point out there was a difference between them, and that Yaakov was more worthy, and he refused to listen. And she said to him, but Esav is fooling you. And he said, no, he's not fooling me. I cannot be fooled by my children. So she devised this mirmah in order to show Yitzchak that he can be fooled.
Yeah, so that's basically dealing with the same tension.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's obvious they never spoke, because, I mean, presumably they had to speak at some point. You know, they met, they went into a tent, he felt comforted from his mother. You can't imagine they lived years of silence. But the problem is the text tells nothing. They don't say a thing. So we've got one of two responses. One is, there must be stuff that was spoken about. The challenge with that is, well, why aren't we told? And then another reason is, no, they really, of course they spoke day to day, but it stresses their inability to really communicate by not putting it there. And the Netziv is the one who says this, and I'll get through this very quickly. And the Netziv says it all comes down to first encounters. When they first met, what happened? She was young, that's true. She fell off a camel. She was romantically driven, said, wow, this guy's great, and fell off a camel. That's the best response. So the Netziv says, why did she fall? And we spoke about this on Shabbat, a couple of us, that actually a lot of people say she didn't really fall, she left, talked to the servants. One person said she just dismounted, got down. But it says she fell. So why did she fall?
And why was she so sure that was Yitzchak?
Right. So one person says, the Chizkuni says she fell because she didn't recognize him. She thought it was a robber. She saw this big, impressive guy walking towards her, not on the road, from the field, because remember, Yitzchak was in the field. Big impressive vision coming, so she just goes, oh my gosh, highway robber, pulls off.
She wasn't there long, she had an ankle
right. It was shock, you're right. I mean, it's strange to fall off whatever you say. When the Netziv says no, why did she fall off? Pachad u'busha. She was embarrassed, and she was terrified, and then he goes on to say, k'moshim izina, as if she understood, she'ena ru'ya li'yot lo li'isha, she felt inadequate to be his husband. She definitely felt inadequate to be his husband, probably more inadequate to be his wife. And then it basically goes on to say, in his words, the way that Avram and Sarah interacted and the way that Yaakov and Rachel interacted never panned out for Rivka and Yitzchak, because the Netziv says she felt intimidated by him her whole life. From that very first moment, terror was sowed in her heart. Terror and intimidation was rooted. She thought, this guy, and the phrase I use is, he's way out of my league. That's the way you say it, right? You don't say, I'm out of his league. I don't know. Whatever. He is way above my league. I can't marry this guy. He's sophisticated. He's spiritual. He's conscious. He's aware of God. He's got an ethical rooting. And what am I? I come from Laban's house. I survived that. But that's high school compared to this is the Ivy League. How am I meant to cope? And then she never was able to talk to him. And the whole point of that was that deceit is sometimes necessary. And then it's even others say this was the way it had to go, maybe because she had to teach Yitzchak a lesson. According to the Radak, the whole scene is so that we shouldn't be mistaken into thinking that those who are righteous have easy lives. The whole point is to say that people who are righteous have trauma and tragedy and deception and difficulty and hurdles and challenges. Life is not straightforward for the righteous. That's the Radak. That's the whole point of this deception. So it has to happen. But it's not something we revel in. It causes pain, it causes problem, and if we can, we should seek to correct it. And all that is because Doeg is sheker midaver tzedek. He loves the justification to go behind the scenes, to corrupt and twist. He loves telling white lies because he thinks he can justify it. I have the ethics I am, what was it Nixon said in that interview that when he got taken down? He said, the president is the law, or something like that, right?
He said, I'm not a criminal.
Well, he said, I'm not a criminal, and then he said, well, you broke the law. And he said, the president makes the law. And that's when it all went down, because everyone said, oh, hold on a minute, no one is above the law. And that's what Doeg is saying. He's saying, I am the head of Sanhedrin. I make the rules. The rules are here, they're for me to manipulate and exploit and twist and corrupt, and he is wicked because he corrupts goodness. Let's continue. See if we can finish this parak today. Let's hope. God. So he's now talking about Doeg. Dam a'el yitaksas l'netzach. God will smash you forever, Doeg. Do not think, and this is vicious. Do not think you're going to get away with this. This is not a slap on the hand. You are going to be smashed. Yachtecha, the yischacha, may ohel. You will be swept up and torn out from the tent. And again, if we want redundancy, do you need both? Swept and torn?
So,
they're two things, right? One is to be swept, which is kind of a gentle motion. Meaning if you give way, we'll sweep you out. But if you cling on, we're going to tear you down. This is not something we're bashful about. This isn't having people who are corrupting power. We're not kind of easy and queasy about treating. We are going to sweep you out. And if you refuse to move, we're going to tear you down. May ohel, from the tent. What on earth does that mean? Just say we're going to sweep and tear you down. What tent are we talking about? You're going to be swept out of the tent? So there are a number of readings. One is, that this is to do with your moed or sanctity. You're going to be swept out of anything sacred. And the rabbis, for the rabbis, what is an ohel usually?
A grave.
Ah, so if you're looking at ohelos, it can mean a grave. When it says a bet midrash, when they talk about Yaakov being ishtam. So with Avram sitting in his tent, it's haknaset ochim. When Yaakov is ishtam yoshev ohelim, which sits in tent, says Hume, he's a studious person. And the rabbis say that nothing Achitofel ever taught will be taught in the Beit Midrash, wiped out. And this is often an ethical dilemma we have. In the most extreme form, and this is Lahavdil. What did I say? Doeg. God, and he was someone else's wife. I know he's good. Okay. Whatever Doeg, I was thinking Achimelech and Achitofel is a bad figure, so God, whatever. Doeg's teachings would ever be taught. And again, distress. In the most extreme form, and there's a debate about this in halachic literature, one of the most vicious things done in the camps during the Holocaust was medical experimentation. And many doctors have asked the ethical question, experimentation was done on twins, that is depraved and wicked, and there were scientific results. Can we use those results in research? And our impulse is, no. The ends do not justify the means. No, you can't touch it. But if you're an academic or a doctor or someone inflicted with a deathly disease, you're going to say it was wicked, it was unjustified, but it's here, and I'm dying, so let's use it. So the question is, if you have someone or the source of something which is meaningful, which is a corrupt source, you write off everything that comes. And that was the most extreme form. But we have rabbis who get into scandals.
Would that qualify?
So Elisha ben Abuya, we can give a whole shiur on about him. There was actually a novel written about him with historic fiction, As a Driven Thief, which is quite a dense book, but also meaningful. But if rabbis get into scandals, contemporary rabbis who have written articles and published and given heterium and given you psak, or that beautiful Divrei Torah. And then it comes out that they were abusing children or something. What do? You burn the books? You don't read the Divrei Torah? It's an ethical quandary. And I don't think there is a straightforward solution. To give an example of music. If someone is a composer, and I'm not going to use a particular name, but I think you know who I'm referring to, who is kind of shrouded in controversy, and it's all rumor. So you can't really pin the person down one way or the other. But how should we feel about using a melody that was composed by somebody who lived an ethically questionable life? Do we say we can separate the product from the source or not? So that's an ethical question. And here David is taking a particular stance. He's saying, Yachtacha b'yischacha me'ohel. Anything you ever taught, anything you ever contributed to society is wiped out the tent. And to some degree it's the equivalent of what ancient Egypt used to do, which was,
cross your name off all the pillars, you know, as if you never existed.
The Sheresh Kham Eret Chaim Sela, and you are going to be rooted out the land of the living.
What does that mean, rooted out?
Very strong walls.
Very strong. It is, right? It's really harsh. And this is reserved not for someone who is just plain wicked. And it's not for Sha'ul who is kind of haunted by some sort of paranoia. This is someone who should have known better. This is someone who's head of the Sanhedrin and took advantage of power. And that's where we have the most critique reserved for people who should have known better. Yeah. Right, to wipe them off the pillar, no record. In fact, a movie's coming out now. I just saw a trailer for it called Spotlight. Anyone see the trailer for this movie? You saw the movie? It looks interesting. I'd like to see it. It's about the cover-up from the Catholic Church and priests who are abusing children. The Boston Globe did a whole expose on it, and it's about their experience tracking down the information. And to some degree, our utmost scorn should be preserved for the people who should have known better. People who are just wicked or have been brought up in places that train them to hate and fill their head, they become sociopaths. They're trained to dehumanize people and they need to be stopped, but we can't preserve this kind of language for them. It's people who have been trained to be compassionate, sympathetic, and then used it to exploit others. That's the way. Yeah. We'll take one question and then we'll finish up. Right, so Achitofel is another interesting figure. Maybe we'll come up with a Tehillim that refers to Achitofel. According to the Gemara, there was a whole bunch of things that led to him hanging himself, and he was there present with David when they were trying to save the world, and he refused to speak up. He's got a whole interesting lore with him as well. So let's finish up. The Yutzadikim, Hazuket. And the righteous will see you, Doeg, v'yirau, and they will be awed. V'alav yishaku, and on him, what's yishaku? They will laugh. So do you, yishaku definitely mean laugh? What else can yishak mean? Right, it can mean to jibe or to provoke. And I think it doesn't mean people are going to think about Doeg and go, ha, Doeg, what an idiot, ha, ha, ha. Yishaku alav, they're going to use his name as a slur. And I came across very recently, I'm sure many of you are more familiar. Anybody heard the phrase quizzling? Yeah. If you call someone a quizzling? Yeah. So I've not heard this till last week. It's just a generational thing, I imagine. He was the head of the Norwegian government during the Holocaust, and he was basically just cooperated with the Nazis. And now anybody who...
During the Second World War, not just during the Holocaust.
During the Second World War as a whole. Right, correct. He was... So people, if someone kind of cooperates with an evil occupying force, you say you're a quisling, you have no standards, no conviction, no backbone. So I think that's what he's saying. Doeg is going to be you, so you're being such a Doeg, meaning you're taking advantage of power. Don't be a Doegite, whatever it was. Your name is going to become associated with that. The hero does not put his trust in God, his stronghold. The Yiftach Barov Ashro, he loves his wealth. Your Obar Toe. Who would be strong in his disaster? And we're going to kind of rush through because I don't want to leave this hanging to do two psukim next time. Va'ani, and I, says David, kazayit ra'anan, I am like a verdant olive tree or a fresh olive tree. Bevet Elohim in the house of God, and I wanted to stress the word bevet here because what triggered this whole disaster was Doeg saying, oh, he went into Beit Achitofel. So you might think, from this, we should never make associations, we don't want to give rise to accusations, but David is saying, I'm not ashamed. But Beit Elohim, I will consult with what is right. I will go into the house of God and not sit back and never associate with anything in public. And this was a response to a lot of Jews in history. They say, look, I'll be a Jew in my house, and in the street I'll be a Frenchman, or a German, or an Englishman. And David is saying, Beit Elohim, I am proud and happy to be known to be in the house of God, and even if you have these twisted people, that's their problem. I will trust in the kindness of God forever. I shall acclaim you forever, for you have made God, David says, I will hope for your name, it is good, before your kind people. Okay, so we kind of rushed through the end there, but it just wasn't worth doing one pasuk of this next time. Next time, we're not meeting next week. But the week after, we'll meet, and just so that you know, we didn't do... Perek Nuntet, chapter 59, which is about David trying to escape out the window when Sha'ul sends guards to assassinate him in the night. So,